Hi, my name is Liz. I'm from Vienna, and this episode is brought to you by DistroKid. Did you know that you can use DistroKid's free Spotify Canvas generator to quickly and easily make a Spotify canvas for your songs? This is a great way to personalize your music and help you stand out in a crowd. Take advantage of this awesome function and so many more using our DistroKid discount link, distrokid.com/VIP/MPW.
What am I saying?
This is MPW, the podcast with your host,
Zylo Aria. Cool.
A podcast about music production
for the everyday musician,
where we learn from experienced studio engineers and each other.
Clinton McCreary is a Grammy-nominated and MOBO Award-winning mixer and engineer. Recently, he worked with Enni and Georgia Smith on the track Peng Black Girls, and other client credits include Ruby Francis, Louis Vega, Zara McFarlane, and Kofi Stone, amongst others. DJing from the age of 15, he has a passion for hip-hop, jazz, R&B, and house music.
Hi, Clinton. It's so great to have you finally on this podcast. I've been chasing you for a little while. How are you doing this morning?
Yep, I'm not too bad. Thank you very much. Quite early on this side of the pond.
Yeah.
But we made it. We've eventually made it.
We did. We did indeed. So before we get into automation in mixing, which I'm very keen to chat to you about, can you tell me a little bit about your career and where did it start in music and how did you get to where you are today?
Broad question. That I guess the general start is that I felt like I was already in music before I was even born, to be honest. Obviously, my dad being Jamaican was a big influence on the sound in the house. My mum was a big soul girl. So there was a lot of that in the house. And my brother is 6-7 years older than me. And he was the cool one. So he was bringing all the cool new stuff into the house. So before I had a choice, really, there was music in every room in my house. So I think that's the foundation, really. And my brother was a DJ and part of a DJ collective at the time. At first, it was just social, just him and friends would come around and just play music. And I remember one day saying to my brother, I can do that. And I tried and it was an epic fail. And I remember that kind of giving me that, oh, wow, I can't do this, you know. And I think from there, that kind of started the real passion of music. You know, every time my brother would go out, I'd sneak into his bedroom and start his stuff up and basically start messing around on decks.
It's so much harder than it looks, isn't it?
Well, it was then. It was vinyl.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah. So back then it was a bit harder. So that was nice. That was my real start, I guess, into music, into like, I guess, thinking about music in a conceptual way. And then, yeah, eventually I joined that kind of collective and we ended up getting put with a label called La Dolce Vita at the time. And they basically just took us around the country DJing as a collective. So that was my first time really on the road. And I was like 16, 17 then at the time. I guess that was kind of my real introduction into actually doing music. So when I was looking around and a lot of the records that I like, this same guy called Tony Economides kept coming up on Mixed and Mastered By or Recorded By. So luckily I had friends that kind of knew him. So I ended up hitting them up and was like, well, I need to introduce me to this guy, et cetera, et cetera. And I sent him an email saying, oh, I'm in Wood Green, which is obviously where his studio was. I'm in Wood Green later today. Do you mind if I pop in and meet you face to face? And he was like, oh, well, since you're in the area, sure. And then I was like, oh my God. So I had to quickly rush and get ready in Reading, you know, and get on the train and just come. That eventually got me in with Tony at that point. So by the time I finished university, I was already an assistant Tony, basically already had a job in music because I was already getting paid. And Antonio owned a property as well. So he was like, at one point he asked me, he was like, how do you feel about living in my house? So he was like, how do you fancy being my full-time assistant and living in the house? So I was like, oh yeah, perfect. So yeah, I moved in and I've just not left. I'm basically still here years later. And that's basically how I got into studios, mixing, mastering, et cetera, and I just basically worked coming up under Tony until I ended up getting my own clients. And then we couldn't coexist in one studio because we were both too busy. So we ended up building another room in the house at the front of the house. doing the whole acoustic stuff, building the room within the room and treating it, etc. So now I've got a studio at the front of the house. He's got a studio in the back of the house. And now his family lives in the house. And he has two kids, also musicians. So now it's just a big musical household with two studios.
Oh, wow. Okay. So maybe it's come full circle from your family's household being a full house of music to another house of music that you're in. Yeah. So can you tell me about one event in your life that you feel like you've learned the most from?
I would say the Grammy nomination that I had would be the thing, because it has so many layers to that. When you first get Grammy nominated, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe this happened to me. Because I was in university at the time when that happened. So it's like, wow, what an achievement. Then you go through the idea of, oh my God, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to buy my mum a house. Then you go through the reality of that it's not quite what you think it is. And then you get the hindsight of, okay, I could have actually utilised that more, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, it's not about accolades. It's about why I'm here, the music, the soul, the feeling. So I'd say that Grammy nomination, to this day, I'm still learning things about myself and what that meant and what that means. So, and it was quite a pivotal moment. Although it wasn't a pivot that I thought it was going to be, it was still the massive pivotal moment. So I'd say that event was amazing and great. And I think I've learned and still continue to learn from that experience.
That's really interesting how many layers that there seem to be within that, and over years, you know, the different lessons that you've learned from it. So that's awesome. Definitely. So can you tell me also, what is a random fact about yourself that maybe not that many people in the industry know about you?
Yeah, there could be plenty of funny ones, I must say. I love tea.
Okay.
I drink I'm going to call it English breakfast tea so everyone can understand what a bit of a snob I am about tea. So I'm actually going to name it. But even now, I still drink my tea with oat vanilla milk.
Mm.
So it's very particular.
Mm-hmm.
And my cupboard's filled with tea. Different types of tea. When I went to Egypt, I just came back with loads of tea. When I went to Malaysia, I came back with loads of tea. So yeah, I'm a bit of a tea fanatic. So obviously when vocalists come and they're like, oh, I've got a bit of a sore throat before we record, do you have tea? And it's like, I bore them with the list of tea that I have. I'm a bit of a tea fanatic. And I did have one before we started today. So
lovely. Yeah. I've been buying almond milk recently, but then I went back to oat recently, not vanilla oat, but just the normal oat. And I just forgot how good oat milk is in tea.
Perfect.
It's so good. So yeah, nice.
I'm actually allergic to nuts, so I can't have almond milk. Unfortunately.
Well, you've got the good one anyway, so
yeah.
It's fine, yeah. So getting into our topic today of automation in mixing, can you tell me, firstly, why would someone want to use automation in mixing?
It's funny, automation has a kind of timeline of what it means. I think it's why people used to use it and then why people use it now are quite different. But the general idea is, I suppose, of why someone would want to use automation is that creating static levels within a mix aren't always the best representation of the sound itself. So for instance, let's just say, I don't know, in the first verse, you've obviously got your vocal sit where you're quite happy and you like it. We get into the chorus and now the vocal feels a bit lost. So the answer to that would be, well, just turn up the vocal a bit. So it kind of creates that balance that you like throughout a moving mix, not a static mix. And that works on every parameter. So maybe in the verse you want the vocal dry, and then in the chorus you think, actually want the vocal to sound more spacious and big, so then you automate your effects, so there's more reverb and then there's more delays in the choruses, then obviously the verse it can be automated back down again, and then there you go, you've created already movement and a dynamic. So that's kind of the general idea of automation and why I'd want to use it. You want to use automation to kind of create movement and to keep the feeling and the balance of the mix that you intend it to be. That's how I interpret it anyway.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. So you're saying kind of started off being to fix certain elements in the recording, but now is adding more movement to the song overall. So I know you mentioned you can automate anything. Are there certain elements that you would be automating a lot of the time more than other elements?
I constantly automate volume in everything that I do. Even if I've recorded and I've done some tracking, I will automate afterwards. I record mixing in the mixing, in the mixing stage, and sometimes even in the mastering stage, I will automate. So volume for me is the biggest one that I think I would automate. And you can automate also, by the way, with the digital world in different ways. Obviously, before, automation was only used by moving faders. You can also automate, you know, if you take a word and you chop that audio and put it on a separate track and then change the volume of that word, that's still automation. It's just in a different way. So yeah, even when before I even start a mix, for instance, I will automate stuff. You know, you hear certain sections and be like, okay, this sounds a bit loud in this section. I might cut the audio and turn that audio region down a decibel. Okay, cool. I want this vocal to pop out a bit more when it first comes into the second chorus. Okay, let me turn up the audio. Do you know what I mean? So I'm always automating volume. And I guess the other stuff is more for effects based and like specialist ideas, but generally I'm always automating volume.
Okay. Now that's good. Good thing to note that that's such a big chunk of your automation. And when we talk about automation complementing the song, can you tell me what do we mean by that?
To me, this goes into energy, emotions, feeling. Like, how can I enhance the song here? And it's, again, I think about this in sections. Like, a song always has a structure. And if your automation can follow that structure, it can enhance it. So, again, going back to my example that we spoke previously, if we're into a chorus and the chorus, the artist is shouting, then maybe the same static volume level that you had in the first verse now don't really complement the chorus because the artist is now shouting, but now they're the same level. It feels unnatural. The energy is not increasing with the performance. So maybe by automating the volume up, maybe adding an EQ that's a bit more, brings out a bit more highs, maybe adding a bit of distortion on that vocal. All these things can kind of add to the performance of the intended emotion that the artist meant to. Maybe your first verse can be quite mono, and then the chorus can be very stereo. All these things are aiding the performance to you and helping you connect with the experience. I think music is an experience. It's not just, you know, just people talking for no reason. It should be an experience. It's a compelling performance. And it's all about feeling, really, at the bottom line. So the first question really everyone should ask is, how can I enhance the feeling of this record? And automation becomes a big part of that. And thinking of sections, what's coming next, where am I now, can really help with that. You know, you want the chorus to feel bigger than the first verse, but then you don't want the second verse to feel too boring and flat after the big chorus. So how do you do that? Well, you can use automation. Maybe the kick drum to dB louder in the second verse to keep the energy up. Maybe that synth sound is a bit brighter in the second verse so it doesn't have such a drop. These are, again, all parameters of automation that can allow you to do that. So for me, after those examples, I guess to answer it quite frankly, I think using automation to enhance a performance literally means that find the compelling emotional performance and use whatever tools are available to you to enhance that with various different parameters.
Okay, yeah. No, that's really good, and working with the song to find the magic and bring that out a little bit. So that's great. And you were talking a little bit about sections of the song and moving from the chorus to the verse and the change in energy. How do you go about, and you gave some examples of this, but like building contrast within sections to keep that interest, like you were saying?
Again, I think using the tools that you have. So you could use a lot of volume can help. Like, for instance, a general consensus could be, okay, you could start mixing your record from the last chorus of the song. Why is that a good idea? Because it's the loudest part, it's the biggest part of the song, and you want that to sound as big and as great and as grand, if that is obviously the intended by the artist, if that's the intention, as possible, right? So then you can think, okay, so we've got this last chorus. It's got space, depth, width. It's sonically pleasing. There's a lot of energy. There's high frequency, there's low frequency. Okay, so you've covered like a lot of bases there. It's very full spectrum. Great. But so then you can almost work backwards, but the first chorus has to be bigger than the first verse, but not as big as the last chorus, right? So then you can kind of start to pull back on what you've already got. This is the way I think about automation anyway and how I approach it. So then your first chorus can be less grand now. So it might not be as much reverb. Maybe you're not as wide in a stereo field. Maybe your kick drum isn't as loud, et cetera, et cetera. Let's say, for instance, that you want intimacy. Well, then the way to create intimacy is to create something that's not intimate. So let's say you've got this really grand, massive chorus. It doesn't feel very intimate. It feels grand. It feels massive. It feels lush. But then let's say you go into the verse, you strip away all that reverb via automation. Now all of a sudden the vocalist comes straight ahead of you. There's none of that kind of processing space around. And you've got this real vulnerable, lonely almost vocal, completely brings you back into the intimacy. So for me, that's what I think about with contrast. For every time, you can't have light without dark. You can't have wet without dry. You can't have loud without quiet. So that's for me. That works on the individual level in music, but it also works within sections. So that's how I'd kind of create that contrast. There's, loads of tracks that kind of utilize this. Even down to the simple idea of like automating your master bus. You know, you might have your master bus at 0 dB on your last chorus, but the rest of the song before the last chorus, the actual master bus setting was at -1 dB. So you've had a 1 dB boost at that last chorus, just to give the listener that whole feeling and impression that, wow, it's just got a lot bigger. Obviously, 1 dB is not big enough for it to have a noticeable difference to the average listener, but it's enough for you to feel it. And I think sometimes that's more important. So yeah, I think that's always the way to create that contrast, right? Which I always think about. If I've got something in a track that sounds beautiful, my first thought is, what can I make sound not nice to show off how beautiful this is? You know, if there's, because if you think about it, everything's got reverb on it, then nothing's got reverb on it. You know, it's kind of an interesting point. You know, if everything's in the middle, then nothing's in the middle. You always need something to complement the opposing factor. So if you've got a vocal that's really dry, but everything else is really wet, well, then you're creating that depth straight away. The vocal's going to stand out because you've got something in the forefront and you've got everything else in the background. Obviously, if everything's got reverb on it, then everything's just in the background, which means that nothing's in the background, right? It's a bit of a mind twister. So I always try and think about things in that context. Like, what is the opposing factor and how can I create the contrast to show off what I'm intending to show off?
Okay, that actually kind of mentions a little bit what my next question was going to be about, because I remember one thing you said to me once was that humans can really only concentrate on three elements at a time, and how can you use automation to keep the focus on those things? So you mentioned certain things there of, you know, to make something beautiful, make something else not beautiful, or put it in a different space. Are there any other tips that you haven't mentioned that you want to say on that?
Well, with the free sound rule is quite cool because it keeps you focused on the production and the performance. So if you know that your listener can only really hear, concentrate, take in only three sounds at any given time, you need to make sure that the three sounds that they are taking in is what you intend them to be. So let's say, for instance, the song was written on the piano. So the piano is very important. And then there's the artist, which is obviously really important. And then there's bass, for instance, the bass playing along. Then there's obviously loads of other different production stuff. But when you strip the song back to what its intention is, you've got a piano, a bass and a vocalist. So you can almost say to yourself, okay, at any given time, I've decided that they prioritize these three tracks and sounds. So I need to do whatever I can to preserve this because this is the song. This is what's intended. And these are the most important factors. So, you know, the hi-hat may not be that important in this moment. The synth line might not be that important at that moment. The strings may not be that important. So you've already got to decide to yourself what is important to this record and what do I want the focus of my listeners to be focused on. And then everything else becomes the subgenre or subcategory, if you like, of those elements. And again, that's where automation comes in, because the synth line might be quite loud in certain sections. And then you think, hold on a minute, I'm losing the piano because I'm focusing on the synth line. Okay, so in this section, I need to turn down that synth line or maybe EQ it separately or in a different way so it's not getting in the way of the piano. I need to make sure that the piano is what's been focused on. So I think that's how I interpret automation in the sense of what you're saying. I think that's a decision-making part of the production and of the mixing engineer at the time to know, to focus on, okay, what is important in this record? And once you've established what's important, everything else just works around it. You know, just like a vocal, at the end of the day, if you've got a vocal and you say, okay, this is the most important part of the record, and then at one point in a chorus, for instance, there's loads of music comes in and now the music feels quite dominant. Okay, well, maybe you want to EQ out a little pocket in the instruments in the chorus just for that section where there's a lot of prominent vocal frequencies, which is normally between the like 1K and 2K area. So you're always making compromises when you're doing music, basically. And certain things you've got to be willing to compromise and certain things aren't. And I think that's a good place to start, is what elements in the mix is most important. And everything has to just work around that. And I find that it kind of just slots together from there, because you must have this yourself. Even as a fan of music, when you listen to a song you've loved for years, one day you'll listen and you go, oh my God, I never heard that sound before. And that to me is the wizardry of music and the wizardry of a really good mixing engineer, is that you have to really pay attention to the details to really hear what's going on. For someone who doesn't necessarily care, even, to be honest, about the details, they just want to hear a good song. You want to be able to give that to them. Like, you know, there should be layers. If you want to hear a good song and not think about music, here you go. You know, if you really care about music and acoustics, listen a bit deeply. Wow, look at that reverb tail. Look at that cool effect in the background. Oh, listen to that really panned ride cymbal that's going off to the side. I never heard that before. That's kind of the next layer. Then you can go, I guess, even deeper than that with cool sub effects and background noises and swirls and that kind of stuff. Like, what's the bed of the record? It's funny, an analogy of this, which I really got into years ago, is that there's a fish tank competition that goes on in the world, that people design fish tanks to make it look the best they can. And I found it was a really good analogy for music, because in while they're doing the fish tanks, they're thinking about the depth of field, the focus, you know, what's on the side, how to complement the stereo. Obviously it's not stereo, but it's the view, the left and right view. You know, put certain rocks at the front that are bright, certain rocks in the background that are dark, to kind of create this contrast of it looks like there's more depth in the fish tank than what it actually is. And I think that's a really good way of thinking about it in terms of sound. Like, you've got left, right, back and forward. And that's what all of this allows things to do. The contrast allows you to do that. And then automation is the vehicle that allows that contrast to exist.
Okay. Yeah, I really liked that three-element concept that you mentioned there. It just helped to, like you said, make some decisions that will help fit everything else together. Is that almost where you start the mixing process, to try and think of what's the most important thing? Is that what you're looking at before you do anything?
Yeah, that's much the start of everything that I do. And in Logic, you can open a little notes section. So on every mix that I start, I just listen first and I start to write notes on the elements that's most important. Like, what is the rhythmic element? What's the supporting musical element? And what's the general emotion of a record? Like, they're just basic questions that you can ask yourself every time. Because it's not always the drums that's driving the record. Sometimes it's the bass that's driving the record. And if it is the drums, it's not always the kick drums. Or sometimes the snare is the main groove element of it. Or sometimes the hi-hat can be the main groove element. Without listening and taking that in first, you can make really bad mix decisions that can take away from the performance. And then I always try and find the song. I always say that to people as well. And the song to me is almost like, how was the song written? Most songs are written with someone playing a guitar and then they write a song while they're playing the guitar, or someone's at a keyboard and they whatnot. So I try and find the bone structure of the song, and that's normally how I kind of start my mix. You start with the idea of, okay, let's make the song the best it can be. Then the other important part might be the rhythm section. So let's just say, I don't know, the hi-hat. So, okay, cool. Let's work the hi-hat, the piano and the vocal. Let's make sure that that is the best it could possibly sound. Then everything else kind of fits in. If the snare starts to sound too loud compared to the hi-hat, well, then I'm ruining the integral rhythmic part and the focus of the rhythmic section of the song. If the synth line's coming up more than the piano that was written on, well, then the synth line is now getting in the way of the piano. It's ruining the song, if that wasn't the intention. But then you've got the other side where, like, when you've stopped singing and that synth line comes in, again, this comes into automation, turn the synth line up, let it live, let it have that moment. So then now you've got one of your three elements is now gone.
Mm.
Somewhere else can fill that space. So now let that synth line scream and really enjoy it, which is what rock was really good at. You know, the air guitar is a really good analogy of that. Like, turn up the guitar solo loud enough that your dad wants to do air guitar. That's always a good point.
That's good. I haven't heard that one before, but it's good. Oh, nice. Yeah. And is there anything that you would like to add on automation with relation to the stereo field and how you use that?
I mean, nowadays, I think people use a lot of, like, stereo plugins that kind of ping pong around the stereo field, which I think is quite cool. They don't necessarily use, you know, automation for stereo fields. I think it's an interesting question because a lot of it is based in the production at the time. You can't create a massive stereo field using automation if the stereo information isn't there, essentially. So, but using the analogy that I spoke about earlier, it more, you can start with something that is big and wide and then automate things smaller. I find that's a lot easier way for me personally to think about these things, whether we talk about headroom and loudness. Okay, let's start at the loudest part where you've got the least headroom and then work backwards. Let's start at a place that has the most air information and then make things smaller. I always find that that's easier because we're always constrained. You know, zero is only zero. We can't go no louder or wider than that. You know, just outside our speakers, the furthest we're going to go. So we can almost start at the widest part and then use automation to narrow it. Things down. I find that being the best idea, really. And that can be quite playful, you know. The only time I really think about stereo automation for me, if the production allows and the client's up for it, sometimes you can do stuff like with intros can be quite interesting. You know, an intro to a song can be quite, can feel quite small and mono. And then when the song drops, everything goes into stereo, which just gives a sense of like, bang, wow, what just happened? This sounds massive now. That can be really cool, those sort of tricks. Also, I do that quite a lot on effects. You know, if you've got a reverb on a vocal, try it. Narrow the vocal reverb so it just sounds like depth with the voice. And then in a chorus or in certain parts of the song, you can then open out that reverb so it sounds more stereo. Again, it's just creating that contrast and that movement within a record. And it's interesting, you know, especially with we're in a headphone generation now, you know, and these things sound amazing in headphones. So but for me personally, like I said, I would start with things sounding bigger and then I use automation to make things smaller as opposed to making things sound bigger. I think start big and get smaller when necessary. That's how I approach it anyway.
That's a nice way to look at it. I like that. Are there any types of automation that you would or may want to avoid?
Stereo wideness can be an issue. That's a common mix problem that I have, people automating or just pushing stereo wideness too far. If you push the stereo far enough without even worrying about the fact that it can cause phase issues, which is a bit of a problem because you're phasing out the mix, so it's going to sound wrong. And feel wrong. It's odd when you hear something out of phase, especially if it's sat in the middle of two speakers. But more importantly, for me at least, I think if you push things too far wide, then you lose the middle. And that could be detrimental because when you think about the middle of a record is where mainly your three elements are. The main focus three elements are always going to be in the middle of just the phantom image. So like drums, vocals, etc. So if your stereo field is overpowering the middle, you're going to lose punch, you're going to lose intimacy, all your effects are going to feel too loud, etc., etc. So that's the first thing I would say is something to be definitely aware of. when you're automating some of these tools, don't go too far as to in terms of these stereo filled plugins. The second thing is knowing when to use automation and when not to. Like I said before, I use automation very early on to just correct certain things that jump out to me. I also use automation early on to even out a vocal, because I don't want to allow a compressor to just do that by itself. So we'd use automation to chop out a word or a phrase and turn that phrase up so it's more equal. So I go through the vocal performance and turn down the really loud stuff, turn up the really quiet stuff, enough that it sounds natural now. So when I do put like a compressor on or something on later, processing on the vocal later, I'm not relying on the processing to do loads of work. So trying to keep it as natural as possible. So the function of automation for me is very corrective early on. Automating though creatively, like volume levels and sections and that sort of stuff too early can be a problem, because you kind of paint yourself into a corner that is difficult to get out of, because you've got almost focused on things before you've created a foundation to build upon. So generally the creative style of automation, like when you're thinking about how to make things smaller or how do I enhance this contrast, we're using automation should be the last 5% of the mixing process. Like when you've actually got everything and it feels right and it feels good and the mixes, the levels are balanced and you're thinking, yeah, I'm happy where I am right now. That's kind of the last part. It's like, okay, how can I enhance performance of automation? You can kind of think about that at that point. Don't go into the mix and be like, okay, yeah, let me, you know, turn the drums up here. Let me add the reverb here. Because then you've kind of lost the foundation first. Build a strong foundation and get everything right. And then use automation only as an enhancement. And by the way, it's absolutely fine to have no automation. There's plenty of static mixes out there where you've just set the faders and you get things right and it just feels good and locked in and you leave it alone. So that's the other thing. It's a very emotional and feeling based industry that we're in, right? This whole recording and mixing and mastering. So if it feels right, leave it alone. I think that's another big tip to have. And if it don't feel right, then don't be scared to just automate something. And because we're in a digital age, you can go for it, you know, anything. If you have a wildest thought, give it a try, because it might come with some amazing results that you didn't even see coming. You go, oh, the vocal sounds a bit quiet here. Don't turn up the whole track, just duplicate the track and turn up that track, or, you know, use automation and just turn up that section. So yeah, that's how I would think about going about it. But like I said, it has changed over the years. Obviously before, automation was only available since we had SSL consoles, and it was used because they didn't have loads of compressors and stuff around in the studio all the time. You know, even the best studios in the world, even if they had 10 compressors, which was a lot back then, you can only then compress 10 things, right? Where, today we've got so much plugins and DSP and available to us that we don't necessarily need it to be used as that. That's why I said, I think over years, automation has changed, because now it can be used very creatively.
So now we are at our speed quiz. Are you ready?
Probably not, but let's go.
All right. So it is 5 quick fire this or that question. So
cool.
First one, would you rather give up air conditioning and heating for the rest of your life or give up the internet for the rest of your life?
Ooh, I would rather give up the air conditioning, because I can't work without the internet.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. Would you rather be out of tune or half a beat behind?
Half a beat behind, man. I love the groove.
Nice. Would you rather buy 10 things you don't need every time you go shopping or always forget the one thing you need when you go to the store?
Well, I actually do always forget the one thing that I need. So that's just kind of been chosen for me. My girlfriend would be laughing at that. So, yeah.
Okay, right. I see. Would you rather spend a week in the forest or a night in a real haunted house?
Oh, no way. In the forest, please. I'd rather be in nature than some paranormal activity going on.
Yeah, fair enough. Would you rather produce a song with terrible vocals but brilliant lyrics, or a song with amazing vocals but horrible lyrics?
Melody is king.
Okay.
Everyone from Quincy Jones to Michael Jackson, all the greats knew that melody is king. So if you've got a good melody you can make good songs. There's plenty of songs out there that's got horrible lyrics, by the way. So.
Okay. That was good. That was fairly speedy, I would say.
Okay, cool. Medium.
Yeah, nice job. So coming to our top tips then, Clinton, can you tell me what is your one top career tip?
Keep music first with no distraction. That's my top tip. Everything around you is a distraction. You can get caught up with money. You can get caught up in business. You can get caught up with accolades. You can get caught up in what's cool, what's not. You can get caught up on what's on social media, what other people are doing. Everything comes back to the music. Is this what you intended? Is it a good song? Are you happy with it? It's yours. It's your thing. So keep focused on the music. Everything else is a byproduct of the music. So as long as the music is where you need it, I want it to be, and you're happy with it, that's my top tip, because you'll be pulled constantly. But hopefully your center, what you keep coming back to, is I just love music. I want to do music and I love it.
Mm, that's such a good tip. And I think it in this world that we're in today, there are so many distractions.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to give in to them and have this kind of shiny object syndrome and forget the core of what you're doing. So love that. It's really good. And what is your one top self-care tip?
Love yourself. Do any work or all work that can help you realize that you're amazing, that you're unique, and that you're deserving. Because we all are. We just all have different battles on why we believe we aren't. So it comes to different people at different times, but the kind of self-love and getting over any traumas, or at least acknowledging just any traumas, whatever you've had, for me, is important. Because again, this is a game of emotions. We're playing with emotions, frequencies, emotions, music's an emotion. If I'm not in touch with my emotions, how can I best interpret your emotions in the record? How can I get up every day and perform my best if I'm not in the best place? So it's a double-edged sword of having a good life, making sure you have a nice life pattern and that you're healthy and you're happy, and also keeping your eye on the prize and knowing, okay, I need to love myself, I need to accept my mistakes, I need to embrace my mistakes, learn from them, et cetera, et cetera. Reading books, for me personally, has been the game changer. Different types of books. Books from people that just talk about their experiences, which I found really helpful at the start of my journey, if you like, self-love journey, all the way through to like psychology. I think I find psychology really interesting. And there's amazing podcasts and stuff out there now that you can listen to people talking about these things. So yeah, it's a very important part of life and our career. And I think indulging whatever those niggling things are that you know you probably should be doing, do it, because it's an amazing outcome and it'll help you tenfold in life and music going forward.
For sure. Love that. And you mentioned you like books and podcasts and things. What would you say are your top three resources? It can be a book or a podcast or anything in the self-love category. Are there any you would recommend or your favorites?
Oh man, Sylvester McNutt, he is a great author. He was the first author that got me into this kind of idea, because everyone's on a different journey. So when everyone was on about, oh, self-help and spirituality and looking into yourself, I was like, how do you do that? Like, what is that? Right? So Sylvester McNutt was the guy that he basically just talks about his experiences and starts to break down the root of where they come from and why he felt like he did and what he thought. So he almost breaks down his own journey, which I felt really useful, because he gave me a pathway to my internal issues, if you like. So that was amazing. I can't remember the name of the other one. I can't remember what it's called. It's something like Four Rules for Life or something like that. The Four Rules. But it basically talks about like, don't take things personal and et cetera, et cetera. And it kind of bases your life around
The Four Agreements.
The Four Agreements. Thank you.
That's one of my favorites.
Amazing. Yeah. And it's such a small but powerful book. And then that put me onto all the work that author did. Because he talks about love, he's got one about relationships. And when I say relationships, I mean all relationships. Relationships with alcohol, relationships with money, relationships with your family, relationships with your partners. He is amazing. he's an amazing guy. So that one's my top one, I'd say.
Okay. Yeah. No, love that. I have a copy. I kind of buy it for people just as presents because it's such a good one. Yeah. I haven't actually read anything else by Don Miguel Ruiz, so I'll check it out.
Definitely. The love one he has is amazing. It's amazing.
Okay. I'll have a listen and or a read. And what is your one top general life tip?
General life tip is to do things that make you happy. At all times, I think that's the key. Do things that make you happy and the various things make you happy, not the same thing. Like, I try and live my life by that myself. Like, I go on holidays as much as I can and travel because I love traveling. I'm learning to trade because I like the geekery of trading.
Oh, me too.
Obviously, I do music because I love music. But, like, I do understand that it's just as important for me to go for a walk because I like walking than what it is to produce a record, because they both make me happy, right? And it's important. They say that, don't they? Variety is the spice of life. And I think I kind of live a little bit like that. Do all the things in the world that you can to make you happy, because when you're happy, you do your best work and you give the planet the best version of yourself.
Very true.
So yeah, that's what I try to live by.
Love that. That's so good. All right. Well, I have gotten so much from this episode, Quentin, in lots of different ways, not just about automation, but also about life in general. So thank you so much for spending this time and having a chat.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure I'll speak to you soon.
My biggest three takeaways from the episode with Clinton was, firstly, to start your mix with the loudest part of the song, then move to the quieter sections. This will allow you to start with the biggest sound and have room to get smaller rather than going the other way around. My second biggest takeaway was to create contrast in your mix in different sections of the songs using tools that take you from wet to dry and light to dark, which will keep the interest of the listener throughout the song. My last takeaway was to strip the songs back to the three priority elements so that you can keep the listener's focus on those elements in the different sections rather than focusing on the less important things. That's it from us this week. I hope you enjoyed the episode and we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks.